Welcome to a special web audio extra supplement to Gastrointestinal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. In addition to chatting with Dr. Ellen O'Reilly about pancreatic cancer, we also discussed hepatocellular cancer, and she began by presenting a 68-year-old woman from her practice.
Right, so this was a lady from the Caribbean in her late 60s, and she had been unwell for best part of a year, and she had had several hospitalizations in the New York area, and in fact had discharged herself, even though had been recommended follow-up, and ultimately wound away to Memorial. And her history was notable for diminished appetites, some weight loss, and progressive abdominal swelling and fatigue. And when she came into the clinic, she literally looked like she was 9 months pregnant. And she had had somewhat limited workup, but at the time of her presentation had been known to have an alpha fetoprotein of over 90,000, had a workup for hepatitis B and C and not found to have either, and had a non-contrast CT which showed a huge, which looked to be a somewhat solitary mass from her outside scan. So our next step was to get a high-quality triphasic CT to better image the tumor and its relationship to the vasculature, and also to help assess for the presence of metastatic disease. And one would obviously be very suspicious of that in the context of her very high CA19-9.
She had ascites?
She did not have ascites. We thought she did, but it was pretty much all solid mass, and her subsequent scan showed a huge 20-plus centimeter mass occupying the major portion of her right and part of her left liver, and was relatively solitary. We even had her surgical colleagues come and assess her to see was there any possibility here that she might be a candidate for surgery, but the outflow of her liver in terms of her portal venous tract was somewhat compromised, and the AFP of 90,000 argued against surgery having utility. Her performance status was also limited to more, I think, from disease bulk rather than from anything else. She had pretty well preserved and Charles A function liver. The only thing where she scored a little bit low was her albumin, but she had no ascites. She had normal bilirubin, and she had a normal INR.
What was your thinking in terms of biopsy?
She had had a biopsy outside.
Oh, okay.
And this confirmed hepatocellular cancer, HEPAR1 positive. I think you could argue here that it might not have been necessitated in this patient, given that there's probably no other diagnosis with the solitary mass in the liver and an AFP of that degree, that there's no other diagnosis that really could be entertained. But we have a couple of institutional cases where we have drawn a diagnosis of cholangiocarcinoma and vice versa. So I think ideally, and certainly most of the clinical trials do require biopsy proof.
What would your estimate have been of the risk of biopsy in a patient with this huge hypervascular mass?
So I think it's relatively low. She had an uneventful course. It's not zero. And remembering, too, that sometimes these large solitary lesions can spontaneously rupture and present very acutely. And there, the treatment of choice would be to embolize the primary. She did not have that presentation. But I think the risk is low.
So this sounds like a pretty difficult situation. What were the options that you were thinking about at that point?
Right. So we had sort of a multidisciplinary discussion. Our surgical colleagues came and assessed and felt, and I think appropriately, that she was not best served by a surgical intervention. So options came down to local regional modalities or systemic therapy. And we really don't have a good comparison for this particular patient population as to what to do. She was very symptomatic from disease bulk. And we know that sorafenib very rarely causes tumor response. It certainly may impact on quality of life. But this lady sort of needed a debulking of sorts to, I think, impact on how she was feeling. So we argued here to have our interventional colleagues come see and assess. And the consensus was that she might be best served by hepatic artery embolization. And institutionally, we typically use bland embolization outside of a trial. Many other places use chemoembolization or TACE, although I think it's fair to say there really isn't a well-conducted randomized study that tells us that one approach is better than the other. They may be a little different in terms of their intent.
What's your thinking in terms of going with the bland embolization?
So institutionally, we actually don't give chemotherapy outside of a clinical trial. It's thought that bland embolization probably induces part of its effect from ischemia, as well as direct reduction in terms of arterial blood supply. The TACE approach may have a local regional cytotoxic along with antivascular effect. And as I say, some studies have suggested that TACE may be better, but if you actually look in details, I think it's hard to draw a definitive conclusion. And they've been mostly compared to nothing as opposed to another embolization-based approach.
What happened with this lady?
So that's what happened. She underwent a hepatic artery embolization because of the size of her primary tumor, even though she did not have underlying cirrhosis and relatively well-maintained liver function, was to do a limited embolization to start, and she had her right liver embolized and tolerated that reasonably well, although I would say took some hit in terms of her performance status and did develop some anasarca, lower extremity swelling, and some ascites, but has had a pretty nice response and is now scheduled to go back and have a second embolization for the remaining right-sided part of her tumor and left liver.
What do we know about integrating systemic therapy after or with embolization or TACE, and specifically sorafenib?
Yeah, so that's a key question. Does sorafenib add to embolization? And that's the subject of ongoing trials. I mean, there was a recent presentation at GI ASCO that suggested it may not add, but I think the story is not told here yet, and there are other studies underway that need to mature. Theoretically, it seems that they might have a favorable or an additive interaction together. I mean, you could sort of argue that based on mechanism of action, but that question needs to be answered and I think is not something that we would routinely recommend until there is clearer proof.
How do you go about using sorafenib when you use it in an advanced HCC, and how do you deal with the issue of dose?
So for patients with good performance status and good liver function, and that's probably both of those two factors are key here in terms of dosing. Full doses was utilized in the randomized phase 3 of 400 milligrams twice a day would be the starting point. But I think it's fair to say that we end up dose reducing a lot of patients, even though that's the prescribed dosing, and relatively low rates of toxicity were observed in at least the SHARP study. For patients who have impaired liver function, this is also a topic of a lot of discussion as to whether empirically dose reduction should be employed, and most people would argue yes. As you know, the FDA chose to leave the label open and not prescribe specifically, but there is some suggestion that metabolism may be impaired and toxicity rates higher and liver dysfunction greater for people with more advanced Charles Pugh score, and almost certainly they should be commenced, if you're going to use it at all, with a lower dose of sorafenib, either 200 milligrams twice a day or maybe even once a day for people with higher rates of Charles Pugh liver dysfunction.
Any thoughts about what the specific anti-tumor mechanism of action of sorafenib might be in HCC?
I think that's very interesting. And when it was originally developed, it was as a RAF kinase inhibitor. We now suspect that perhaps at least in the broader population of HCC patients, that its antivascular effect may be the more pronounced one. But the subset of patients with HCC on a background of hepatitis C may be more susceptible to sorafenib because of the importance of the RAF pathway in terms of pathogenesis of their original liver dysfunction and ultimately the HCC. And subsets are being looked at to sort of tease out whether that observation is correct. So there may be a dual mechanism in a subset of patients with HCC.
What about the use of sorafenib as an adjuvant after either resection or transplant?
So I think a very interesting question and the subject of ongoing randomized trials. And until we have the information from those populations, it's hard to routinely recommend it. But it's theoretically attractive given relatively low morbidity rates, but needs to be proven. And it's going to be some years before we have clear data, both in terms of development of new primaries and recurrence of the original, not to mind the whole question of immunosuppression and the use of sorafenib in the transplant population.
What are some of the research questions that are being asked in HCC that you think maybe have some promise for the future?
So I think you've indicated a couple of them. So the adjuvant use of sorafenib and the adjunctive use following embolization are two important practical questions. I think the CALGB have recently opened a randomized phase 2, phase 3 trial combining doxorubicin and sorafenib based on interesting phase 2 data, and that will need to mature. There's obviously some potential for overlapping toxicity, and particularly the cardiac question has to be followed carefully. And so that's an area that is open. I think other targeted agents are actively undergoing development in HCC, erlotinib and bevacizumab, and other antivascular agents such as sunitinib. Where their role falls in distinction to sorafenib remains to be seen, and whether some of these antivascular agents might prove a superior alternative, I think also remains to be seen. Arguably, sunitinib is more toxic and is probably not going to supersede sorafenib's niche in the treatment of HCC.
What do we know about the combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab? It's kind of hard for me to kind of sort of figure out whether it has any activity, actually.
Yes, yeah, so there's some data from the MD Anderson group that looked at a combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib in a selected good performance status group of patients, and also a part of the way through the study actually screened patients and prophylax them for potential for variceal bleeding, which was observed in the initial part. So the results in a very dedicated academic center using these agents with all of the careful follow-up that this patient population needs were provocative. But I think that combination should be reserved to a clinical trial setting until we establish the safety and the generalizability of that combination outside of a limited phase 2 academic center setting.
Have clear-cut objective responses been seen to that combination?
I believe stable disease, but I have to stand to correct myself, and just recognizing that sometimes it can be very difficult to identify whether or not an objective response has occurred in HCC, and this is big research interest, is how to quantitate response with imaging, particularly use of dynamic MRI and volumetrics to look at surrogates for tumor necrosis as response outcomes. And some early data from the sorafenib development has highlighted some of these approaches. And these clinical trial questions are being incorporated in some of the newer studies to see whether they provide a reproducible and potentially superior outcome to RECIST measurements, which we know is limited in many regards in terms of measuring HCC response.
Anything you want to add to what you said today? We covered a lot of stuff and it's been really great. I mean, anything that popped into your head and we kind of got onto another topic?
I think the other area maybe with regard to pancreas cancer that we didn't touch on but is of, I think, interest is the whole story of genetics and family history of pancreas cancer and identifying who might be at risk for this disease and how to screen. And these, for the most part, are research-directed questions at the moment but have important ultimate application in this cancer, I think, because probably the milestones that we're going to make in the advanced disease setting are always going to be limited and modest. And if we really could identify who is at risk for this disease and screen those people, then I think we stand to make meaningful improvements in the ultimate natural history of pancreas cancer. So that's kind of an exciting area in terms of research at the current time.